There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
The Bookshelf. What you should be reading.
We're looking at fairy tales today. In the guest chair, we have Louise Edenser, regular reviewer on Talking of Books.
Good morning.
So welcome to the show. For anybody who hasn't heard you on the show before, would you mind kind of introducing what you do, what you teach?
Sure, yeah. My name's Louise Edenser. I'm a senior lecturer at Middlesex University. So my subject area, my PhD is in English literature. So I teach anything to do with writing. I teach media students, but I also have the pleasure of teaching children's literature. Mm. And so I'm looking forward to this discussion today on fairy tales, which are very controversial in children's literature.
So what are the two books that we've got with us? Because we're talking about two today, two very different books. The first one is it's aimed at YA, a YA audience, I think. It's
The Beauty and the Beast one?
Yeah,
I think so. I actually thought my daughter might like this because she loves fantasy stories. This is called The Beast's Heart, and it's the story of Beauty and the Beast, but from the Beast's point of view. So it's a bit of a different take. We were just talking about it and saying that it does stick very closely to the story, depending on which of the fairy tales you've actually got at home, because obviously they were published more than once. So Beauty and the Beast was originally published in 1740, but then subsequently published again and again and changed over time. But it does stick quite closely to the story. Do you want me to say what the other one is as well? The other book?
Yeah.
So the other book, completely different. This is definitely not a children's book. This is called The Merry Spinster, Tales of Everyday Horror. By Mallory Ortberg. And these aren't all fairy tales, because I noticed Toad of Toad Hall pops up at one point. These are a very different take on fairy tales and don't stick to the story at all.
Which I really enjoyed.
Yes.
But
very,
more on
very
that
unusual.
Later.
Yes. So, shall we talk about the Beauty
and
the
Beast? Let's have a look at the Beast's Heart, Beauty and the Beast. So it sticks very much to kind of what we've already seen. So funnily enough, you should tell everybody that you haven't actually seen
which
the
is
Disney
shocking
film.
I know it's absolutely terrible. I have never read Beauty and the Beast, nor have I seen the Disney film.
How do you
the
go
animated
through
film
life?
Well, I think, I mean, to be fair, I think it's probably been on, obviously I've got two children, so I think it's probably been on the television whilst I've been in the house. But have I actually sat down and watched it? No, I haven't. So I can picture the characters in my head. I know what they look like on the Disney film, but I haven't actually watched it. And I didn't know the story and I had to Google it.
I think you're going to have to take over, man.
Yeah.
I'm a complete shock.
I think we both are. I don't know. I think the Beauty and the Beast story in Disney as well as before Disney, I think it's one of the most interesting fairy tales out there, because I think the female character of Beauty or Belle is the most interesting, because I feel like she's the most layered of all female characters in these fairy tales. I'm not sure about the original, but I know definitely with the Disney, she likes to read. She's more not on the intelligent side, but she doesn't sort of meet this prince and then just falls in love with him. She meets this beast who she's terrified from, but as she gets to know him, something develops. And I think that's kind of a good lesson if you're going to, you know, watch Disney kids, Disney films as a kid. I think that's probably one of the better lessons, as opposed to the Little Mermaid Disney version, which I think is horrific.
I think the thing with this, though, also, is that you've got backstory for both characters. Mm. Whereas in something like Cinderella, you only get Cinderella's story. You don't get the prince's story, do you? But in this one, both the Beast and Beauty have a backstory, don't they? Because in the original fairy tale, she's poorly treated at home, isn't she? In this one, not quite so much. She is still the skivvy at home, isn't she? And they have to adapt when she leaves. But I think that's quite interesting to me, that you've got both of those backstories. So they both learn something from each other. They both get something out of this. Because she actually says to him, when he makes her stay, she actually says to him, well, at least it's a holiday for me. in not those words, but that's basically what she means, doesn't she? Because at home she does all the work, doesn't she?
She does all the chores, and it is a bit of a vacation for her. Mm. And there is one moment where I remember where she was just said, "I've done nothing today," and it's been absolutely wonderful.
Yes, that's right.
I wanted to ask you both, reading this from the Beast's perspective, because the Beast is, you know, he's a bit of a miserable character to start off with, right? Because he's in the original stories, because he's sort of cursed and da da da. And I'm wondering if here he comes off as, it's too much to read just from his perspective the whole time because he is in this curse and he's maybe like a bit miserable, or is it not like that?
I think actually the Beast is the most interesting character. Mm. And I've always thought that from watching the film. And one of the reasons that I liked the live action Disney remake was it spent more time on how the Beast felt about everything that you didn't get in the animation. And I'm actually it doesn't deviate from the story that we know, but it does give you a little bit more of the Beast. And I did like that. I did like that it was from his perspective. And because you quite rightly say, you get a lot of backstory from Beauty anyway because of the device of using the magic mirror. So it doesn't need to be from Beauty's perspective in the first place.
No, that's right. I mean, in this, he's got a mirror which allows him to see what's going on with her family the whole time that she says she doesn't see. But also her sister writes letters which she puts into a box, and the letters magically make their way to Beauty, don't they? So you get everything that's going on in their lives as well as what's happening in the Beast's castle as well. So that actually, because this book's quite long, it's 300 pages long, and you think, okay, how has she spun out Beauty and the Beast for 300 pages? But actually, I couldn't put this down. I mean, I'm not a big fan of fairy tales, and I say I hadn't, you know, I knew the story basically. But actually, I found this really compelling. I wanted to read on. I wanted to know what was going to happen the next day and the next.
We know the basic kind of beats of the story. Mm. And that's the thing about fairy tales and stories that we know and get retold again and again, is we know the basic moments and the characters. Mm. But we don't get to read between the lines enough. And she's done a good job of fleshing all that out without feeling like it's been just padded.
Yes, I think you're right. I think it does make a very compelling story, looking at it from his point of view and seeing what's going on with her family. And also what I felt as well at the end was the sense of her selfishness, actually. That comes across quite interestingly in the story, that she's accused of selfishness in terms of how her father has been absolutely distraught since she left. And she said, well, but the Beast would have been upset if I left him. And her family say, well, what about your father? You know, you left him. And you get that sense of, well, actually, she's learned also about what it's like to be selfish as well as him, which is why he was cursed to begin with.
Yeah. One thing I wanted you to do, because there's a moment that I'd really love to read out, because it illustrates that she's a great writer, and I think that's what makes the story work so well, is she has that fairy tale atmosphere in the language.
She does, and this is where the Beast comes across the fairy. Now I had come upon her, I saw her dress was not, as I had thought, a sumptuous court gown of satin and brocade. Up close I could see it was constructed of clotted cobweb and the velvet wings of dead moths. It was not embroidered with pearls and diamonds, but decorated with the tiny bones of small animals and glittering with spiders' eyes. The veil was no veil, but a drifting cloud of tiny insects glimmering with their own milky iridescence. I hunched down, my hackles rising in fear, and she turned to look at me.
I just thought that was a beautiful moment of description.
Yeah, the thing I liked about this actually is that although there's a lot of magic in it, because obviously once they're in the house, everything that happens is magical, that isn't overplayed. And actually what this is a realist narrative. It's set in the real world. And I think that's what made it more compelling for me, that it's just a love story.
Yeah, and the furniture moves around and things happen in the kitchen, but it's not like dancing furniture or anything. They just kind of take it for granted that the house kind of provides things for them, and it's never really questioned. And I thought that worked really well. They didn't really question it. It just became part of daily life.
Yes, and I think that's deliberately done because it's the opposite of what she had at home. So at home she had to create all of these things. She had to do all the washing and the ironing and the cooking, and she comes here and everything just appears in front of her. And to begin with, that's driven by him, isn't it? So everything he imagines is what appears, and then he realizes that he needs to allow her to do that, to, you know, the dresses that he puts out to begin with, she hates them because they're very, very fancy and elaborate. And so then he allows her to think up the actual dresses that she wears in the evening.
I made a note next to that in my copy as well, the fact that she kept coming down in all these gowns and she was saying, I'm really uncomfortable, they're a little bit too fancy. And then he realises that he's the one who's been subconsciously imposing this on her. And he learns not to do that.
He does, as well. Yes. And it's part of his development and hers, isn't it? That she's exposed to these riches and has to get used to it.
So we were in the middle of talking about the Beast's Heart, which is where we've started. It's quite faithful to the story that we either know from the Disney version or the original La Belle et la Bête, which was originally published in French, I think, in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. I think it was the 18th century. And we will be moving on later to the Merry Spinster, but a couple of things I wanted to talk about. Now, Man, you very kindly pointed me in the direction of a wonderful booktuber called Jen Campbell, who basically makes it her mission to condense all these fairy tales into various origins and themes and etc. But one thing you brought up in the break, Louise Edenser is our guest on the show today, was the difficulty of tracing these origins.
Yes, I mean, if you look at scholars who write about fairy tales, Frank, I don't know whether you say Zipes or Zeeps, I always say Zipes, but he is the authority on fairy tales, and he discusses quite extensively how they were originally oral tales. It's just that we think that they were developed during the 18th and 19th century simply because that was when they were written down. Because, of course, before that, people couldn't read. So these things were told from family generation to family generation. So when you look at the Beauty and the Beast, it says that it was originally written down in 1740, and then it was written again later that century, and then it was published again in the Victorian period because children's stories didn't really come to exist until the 19th century. Mm. So it was republished again in about 1886. So, you know, it may be that we think that these stories are new, but in actual fact, they're a retelling of oral tales from a very long time ago.
Some of the things that came up when I looked at Jen Campbell's take on Beauty and the Beast was, she mentioned that you can trace the history to Greek classics like Cupid, motifs of love and deception, people changing. You've got the Minotaur as well, half man, half bull. That's quite a clear connection when you look at the Beast. You can also trace it to Shakespeare in the 1500s, fairies that changed men's appearance to the head of a donkey in Midsummer Night's Dream. And then you've got similarities with Cinderella as well, which I noticed when I read this version because of the way she's, like you said, sort of a skivvy at home. And her sisters, she's got two sisters who can't really cope without her, but they're not as cruel as the wicked stepsisters in Cinderella. And then also you've got Beauty and connections to like Little Women. Jo and Little Women always makes me think of Beauty and vice versa. And then the other thing that I found interesting was that apparently Beast is based on a real life character called Petrus Gonzalez, and he was born with hypertrichosis, which means you have lots of hair, and it was crudely referred to as werewolf syndrome. He was sold to the French court by his parents so he could perform. He performed to King Henry II and in other courts. He married a noble woman, had 7 kids, 4 of them with the same syndrome, and that was apparently seen as scandalous because he was not deemed to be human by others, because obviously they saw this and it was other. They didn't understand it and they thought, oh, he can't be a human being. So
yeah, I think often if you look at these sorts of tales, they are there to explain things. They're like fables. Mm. Fables tend to explain natural phenomena and superstition. So it's to overcome things that we're frightened of. It's to, you know, if you think you've got a society where people can't read, how are you going to avoid superstition? How are you going to stop people being frightened of things that are natural? Okay, well, we develop stories about it. We tell them to children. They grow up understanding something. And that's how we not control society, but we find ways of
managing it.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of fairy tales are based around those sorts of things. They're morality tales, particularly when they were republished in the 19th century. They were very much morality tales. It was a way of controlling children. It was a way of controlling women. You know, if you do this, this is what's going to happen. You know, if you think about something like Little Red Riding Hood, it's the danger of male predators, isn't it? Mm. But I think it's quite interesting what you were saying about the guy with the, I can't remember the syndrome. I'm sorry, it's a long word.
Whatever
the syndrome was. It's interesting that in French,
hypertrichosis.
There we go. I can't even say it. that word. when I was reading about Little Red Riding Hood, Frank Zietz reports that the prevalence of the story is much higher in areas where they had trials of people who they thought were werewolves. So these sorts of things, again, they play into these sorts of stories, these superstitions, don't they? And this is where, when we're trying to get a grip on what the origins are, you've also got to look at how the tale has changed over time. You know, if you look back to the oral tales and the original, even in something like Beauty and the Beast, there were several versions of it. So if you look back, it will be to address something that was happening at the time.
Yeah, and you mentioned it was a way, especially in the 1900s, of controlling women and women's morals, etc.
Yes, exactly.
And I think even in this, though, it really highlights the fact that the story does have... It does have a problematic reading of the way women are written in fairy tales. I mean, even in this one, which was published in 2018, and I don't know whether I think I expected an update in that respect.
I know what you mean. Yeah, to feminize it. Yeah. I mean, and that's, if you look at modern versions of fairy tales, they do tend to put a feminist spin on, which we can talk about when we talk about the next book.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, even Roald Dahl's funny poem about Little Red Riding Hood, where she shoots the wolf, doesn't she? Yeah, I mean, fairy tales are controversial because we have to think about whether we want our children reinforcing these kinds of stereotypes. You know, and even, like you say, even in this book. It's interesting because in the original tale, she also has two brothers, but she doesn't in this. And, you know, so there's no opportunity in this one for her to ask the brothers to do some of the housework. You know, it's the other sisters who take on the role of the housewife, don't they? So again, we're reinforcing those stereotypes.
In the original, apparently she's visited by the human form of the beast in her dreams, and she falls in love with the dream version of the beast.
Yes.
Which kind of goes against the idea that she gradually falls in love with the beast's personality.
Yeah, I mean, in this one, she dreams of him, but in his pretty state, doesn't she? Yeah, so that's slightly different. Yes, but she doesn't tell him that. She won't tell him what she's dreaming about. So for quite a large section of the book, you know that she's dreaming and that she's having very disturbed dreams, but we don't actually know what she's dreaming of, and she won't tell him, and she doesn't tell him. He doesn't learn that until she goes home and he sees it in the mirror, because she tells her sisters about it. So she keeps that from him. She
I thought that
say.
Was quite cleverly done, the way that you learnt things about her through that mirror, and then you learnt things about him through it being from his perspective.
Yeah.
And I just really, I enjoyed reading it from his perspective. I'm surprised that it's taken this long to see it from his point of view, to be honest.
I think there's some, my sister-in-law was saying there's been a new book of fairy tales that are published from the evil character's point of view.
See, that's what I like reading.
That there's would be quite interesting.
There's one from the point of view of Ursula. From The Little Mermaid, which I read, which is really interesting. It's a good one.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.